representatives of the people, as the Soviets would say. Most of these 2 million are university or technical school graduates, and their numbers are growing daily, as education is guaranteed by the government to all the citizenry of the Soviet Union. There are more college graduates in the Soviet Union than any nation per ratio of its population in the world. In spite of the fact that it came out of feudalism barely over 50 years ago. To this class also belongs the prestige groups, the writers, artists, senior professors, and scientists, according to capitalist propaganda, whose individual talents, rather than their managerial positions, give them their status. The lowest class, according to capitalists, and the Soviets deny any class division, and so have many people we've known, successful authors we've known that wrote Crisis in U.S. cities, No Crisis in Soviet cities, and Muhammad Ali. There are no class distinctions, but according to capitalists, there's a lower class comprised of manual workers and farmers, the proletariat, the workers, in other words, for whom the revolution was carried out and in whose name the party rules. Included here, the office workers and artisans also. The Communist Party is organized according to Lenin's principle of democratic centralism. In theory, the leading units of the party up to the highest are elected democratically. The capitalists admit that. The party rank and file choose delegates to local conferences, who in turn meet to elect delegates to the next highest level until the National Party Congress is elected. The Party Congress, we're better than half done. The Party Congress usually meets every 5 years to elect a central committee which exercises democratic legislative representation in the party between Congresses. The Central Committee of the Communist Party in turn elects a political bureau, the Politburo, as I spelled earlier, P-O-L-I-T-B-U-R-O, and a secretariat to conduct the party's daily work. In practice, say the capitalists, the power flows in the opposite direction, which they do not bear out with any proof. Delegates are preselected, say they, from the top and voted for automatically by the units below. This is denied by even Sweden, that say the people and communities gather to determine their representatives, and they can either be communist or non-party, as long as they're not capitalist. The Politburo selects candidates for the Central Committee, not the other way around, say the capitalist. Again denied by Soviets and social democrats alike. In U.S. political jargon, this makes for a system of self-perpetuating rule of the communist, the technocrats, bureaucrats, denied by USSR, in that we saw movies to that fact showing shop workers, General Assembly line people, being in the highest office of the land, on the Supreme Soviet, and the Presidium, and the Politburo. As you saw, many of them were just ordinary workers. You remember that woman making, refining silk? She worked on piecework on the Assembly. Since any person who wants a party career must be approved by the Communist Party, this is denied also by the Soviet Union, I cannot say. There has to be, of course, in any socialist economy, some strict controls of that economy. The overriding requirement for party discipline overrules any opportunity for open debate or dissension, say the capitalists. Capitalism is not allowed. That is true. And obviously so, no more than there is a socialist congressman in USA, a capitalist economy. There's not even a socialist mayor anymore. So no system will allow someone in its system that's contrary to its economic concepts. Obviously, a socialist or communist society would not allow a capitalist to be high in government. They do have to be evaluated by the people. But the people do it in their communities on their commitment to socialism. same thing that Guyana has had to decide in its referendum, to give certain power and clout to socialist programs. About four-fifths of the Soviet women between 20 and 25 now work full-time or are in school full-time and enjoy equal status completely with the men in the labor force and equal guarantees. Even the capitalists admit a full emancipation of women has taken place. Women comprise more than half the country's doctors. In fact, the capitalists are not being accurate there. It's 70, nearly 80%. And the capitalists say in their historical analysis of the culture, geography, and economics of the Soviet Union that over half of the economists are women, over half of the teachers are women, and nearly 40% of its engineers are women, and over that are lawyers, and over that are judges. You won't find many women judges, and you certainly will find very few women engineers, and the doctor ratio of women is just a small percent in USA, less than 5%. From 1959 to 1965, the number of full-time housewives dropped by half. But sexual equality has not worked its way into the home yet, since the Soviet male does not usually, say the capitalists, keep house or rear children. The Soviets say otherwise. And the Cubans, who the capitalist almanac interprets, have really a genuine equality. The men are encouraged by the government to take direct part in housekeeping, domestic, and child-rearing programs. Consequently, the working woman is still a half-time housewife, say the propagandists, without many of the Western appliances, which, of course, I don't know what that would be, being that the Soviet woman has most all in the cities today that any USA have. And more than that, they have no tenements, no ghettos, no rats, no diseases that come from malnutrition. Even the capitalists admit there's no malnutrition in the Soviet Union, and there are no jobless, as jobs are guaranteed by the government. There are no unemployed. Now, let's go out of this propaganda realm, and let's get into the areas of history. Nearly half of the Central Committee now are women, and that shows that there's still some hangovers of chauvinism, and the Politburo has only a third women. But remember, the Soviet Union came from feudalism only 50 years ago, practically from the caves. Well, over 95% of the people could not read or write, and now there is no illiteracy. Everyone in the Soviet Union can read and write to some degree. That is fantastic. The same is true of Cuba, who even has a much shorter history. Earlier, Russia was converted by Greek Orthodoxy when Ivan III married Sophia, S-O-P-H-I-A, the niece of the last Byzantine, B-Y-Z-A-N-T-I-N-E, emperor. The Russian monarchy then became the standard-bearer for the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church dictated its rule despotically and dictatorially upon the people. Because of this tie to the Tsarist regime, C-Z-A-R-I-S-T, and its opposition to the theoretic grounds for materialism, the communists shut the church down because religion they considered was the opiate of the people. When they took power, for a period, no religion was allowed to meet, even as marriage was banned, to try to create people their program to a marriage to the community. However, they abandoned this and have strict adherence to the domestic family now, the nuclear family, although they don't overemphasize sex as is done in capitalist media. They talk about the bonds of fraternity and the marriage to socialism that binds them together. But to get more popular support during World War II, Stalin made an apparent peace with the church, say the capitalists, and allowed it and other religions to flourish on a limited basis, which as far as all, even critics of the Soviet Union, say there's really not any restriction of religious freedom in USSR unless they propagate capitalism or try to undermine the Soviet state. Judaism did not fare as well, however, according to the capitalists, and because of recent so-called persecutions, which indeed is a capitalist lie, the only thing about there's an entire Jewish community that's fully Jewish, and nothing's done about it. They do not allow the promotion of Zionism, which is capitalism, and a glorified worship of the state of Israel. Obviously, no nation's going to allow people to live within its confines if they have any mass numbers. The Jews are a massive percentage of the USSR's population. There are a few million Jews, and apparently it's not too bad, or they would have all done something very violent about it. Six to ten times as many Jews, according to capitalists, are trying to immigrate today as did 5 years ago. Although statistics show from other studies that it has actually greatly reduced, and that the Jews who do want to leave the Soviet Union do not want to go to the State of Israel. And many of them are now in Austria, living in rather difficult conditions. More than half, even according to BBC, of those Soviets that tried to immigrate have gone back to the Soviet Union because they would not go to Israel, and they became disillusioned, and by the contrast of a non-socialist life, they preferred to go back to the socialist lifestyle of the Soviet Union. Although the Jews are well educated and fill the professional ranks, they have a double burden to bear, say the capitalists. They are officially suspect as rootless cosmopolitans, according to capitalists. There's a prejudice against them. But this has not been borne out by even the most severe critics from Europe and the social democracies. They say they're insufficiently loyal to the Soviet state. Again, I say, yes, they do, if they're Zionists, because all Zionists must be loyal only to the state of Israel, which is God's holy land, the only nation that is chosen by God for the chosen people. Obviously, no nation can allow that kind of thing. Many capitalist nations, for instance, have stopped the Jehovah's Witnesses because of their refusal to give loyalty to the country in which they're in. Traditional domestic anti-Semitism has now been abolished, according to the Soviet Union and Social Democrat studies. It used to be under Tsarist Russia. Anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish feeling was strong all through Europe. Hitler just symbolized it more poignantly and more horrifyingly in the mass murder of people for no other reason than that they were Jewish. The party's treatment of writers led to a protest movement in 1966, which grew out of the trial and conviction of two young writers, Andrei Sinyavsky, S-I-N-Y-A-V-S-K-I, and Yuli Daniel. What were those writers? Both of them were against, openly against, Marxism. The protest demanded a return to socialist legality, so say the capitalists. That is, the right to speak, write, and publish freely. However, according to Soviets and even social democrats, what they were wanting to do was to write and publish freely about Zionism and other ideas contrary to Marxism or socialism. Now, scientists and academics have also mounted protest for greater information, expression, travel, and human rights. However, there's been no non-Jew except one that we know about, and that's Solzhenitsyn, and he is talking even of going back to the Soviet Union, and he was critical, as you know, last week, of the power of the U.S. press, its corruption and decadence, which he said far outdid anything he'd ever seen in the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union allowed him to leave and take his wealth with him. But few of these have been imprisoned or exiled, according to the capitalist propaganda. They admit that very few of these so-called dissidents and what the Soviets call anti-socialist are exiled or are jailed. Because the government, say the capitalists, views their services as indispensable to society. The The communist government, on the other hand, of the Soviet Union, say that unless they do acts of subversion, cause subversion by their rhetoric, they will be allowed to continue in their jobs. Nonetheless, a few writers and scientists and other dissenters have resorted to an underground press, or Samizdat, S-A-M-I-Z-D-A-T, which mimeos and circulates banned capitalist manuscripts and Zionist material. These have been primarily in the form of novel fiction glorifying capitalism or Zionism, plays doing the same, and letters from the prisons of people who have involved in anti-Soviet activity. Also, petitions are circulated by this Samizdat, which apparently there must be some freedom, or it had been long banned if it was a true military dictatorship. Open letters to the administration, which is signed. That's strange. They have the right to do that. And sign them. There must not be too much reprisal. And chronicles of so-called class distinction in the government. Anyway, you have to read both the socialist voices on that subject and the capitalist. No country's perfect. All countries are plagued with high degree of nationalism. But the USA is blinded by its nationalism to the point that it will back open fascist regimes like the South Korean government, the Philippines, Indonesia, Chile, the junta, which are open murderers. Though the Soviet Union did not start industrializing until the late 19th century, and then the communists say it was done, and even world opinion holds that there was no industrializing only on a very minor scale, today, due to the communist or socialist revolution of 1917, her industrial production, even by capitalists, is admitted to be second only to the United States and catching up with her daily. And USA has had a history for its government of over 200 years since 1776. It consists, the industrial production consists mainly of oil, which is over 40% of the world's oils there, steel, nearly 40% of the world's steel, electricity, the most power in the world, cement, pig iron, and every other type of heavy industrials, as well as foodstuffs and textiles. Much of this heavy industry goes into the assistance program to Cuba and other of her allies. Military on Somalia and USSR. Each day we give commentary, history, and geography of nations that are both capitalistic and purported to be socialistic. The world suffers with a high degree of nationalism. Nationalism, though understandable, is a grave danger in a thermonuclear age, when there will soon be 35 nations that will have their finger on a nuclear button. Peace and détente are an absolute essential in these times. Peaceful cooperation between governments and peaceful competition between systems, whatever their economic program may be. This is the conclusion and commentary of the news for this day. As we give some news, world news was given earlier. You can study it if you care in the library. Thank you very much. For you that do not have radios that pick up, we use our shortwave to give you the news, all the world news. We give news excerpts from both BBC and the Voice of America, the Voice of Canada, Guyana Broadcasting Studios, the Voice of America, and the Voice of the Armed Forces. And we even give quotes from the Chilean junta, the dread military regime, reactionary regime in Chile that took over by the coup d'etat. And then it's up to you to assimilate news and study all sides of the opinion. That's why I gave, in the analysis of the Soviet Union, I gave the capitalistic criticisms and the socialist point of view about the Soviet Union. Thank you. Have a very good holiday, day off, doing the things you wish to do. Music will be again shortly. The band will be playing. And today, until the meantime, we should have a television program for children. Maybe The Wizard of Oz or some other of the little comedies that show an emphasis upon at least brotherhood and goodwill. We try not to emphasize violence because it is counter to the interest of youth. We've had no violence in our community, not even children hitting each other. No one even spanks their children by our decision in our democratic forum, our town meeting that meets every week. So we wish to have a film of that type. Tonight's film will be decided by you as you give your vote, cast your vote with the radio, and it'll decide what movie will be shown. We have still some Hollywood movies by video, or we have closed circuit television. You can look at the list and make your decision as we live and abide in all matters by the will of the people. Thank you.